Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Robert Hudson. He is the author of The Monk's Record Player, Thomas Merton, Bob Dylan, and The Perilous Summer of 1966. In it, we learn about Thomas Merton, the most renowned religious hermit of his time, and that he was an ardent Bob Dylan fan. Merton described himself as addicted to Dylan's music. After hearing Blonde on Blonde, he declared, "One is not curious about Bob Dylan. You are either all in or all out of it. I am in to this new stuff." Hudson, focusing on Merton the poet rather than spiritual teacher, shows that Merton's poetry in 1966 was wholly influenced by Dylan's music. That summer was a time of profound personal crises for both Merton and Dylan. Both men suffered physical and emotional trauma at about the same time, and their lives radically changed direction as a result. For Merton, Dylan's music was therapeutic after an affair with a young nurse that nearly cost him his vocation. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Robert Hudson. Let me tell you a little bit about Robert before we bring him on. He is a recognized Bob Dylan scholar, a member of the International Thomas Merton Society, a veteran editor from Zondervan. His book, however, is published by Erdmans here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So we welcome Robert Hudson. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Fred. Thank you.
When we ended last week, we were talking about the year 1966, which is a part of your title. For anyone who wasn't with us last week, we don't want to recap the whole show, but let's talk about that year. Why is 1966 such a perilous year?
Perilous year because Thomas Merton had a spinal fusion operation in March of that year. And at the hospital, he met a student nurse, and they fell in love. Now, of course, this, for a celibate monk, was a major crisis. He could have lost his vocation. For Bob Dylan, it was a crisis because he was at the end of a very exhausting tour, sometimes referred to as the amphetamine tour. He was seriously drug addicted and really could not go on any further. And he had his motorcycle accident on July 31st of 1966. And he was facing, as well, one of the biggest crises in his life.
And with that, where was their redemption? What happened to both of them in the ensuing years? And of course, Merton only had two more years left, am I correct?
Right. That's a huge question. Merton did break up with this woman by the end of 1966. He went on to continue his writing on social issues. And of course, famously in 1968, he went to the East. He traveled to Japan and Singapore and most especially Thailand, where he died in Bangkok. He had a chance to meet the Dalai Lama, and he was very impressed. He was attending in Bangkok a conference of Catholic monks from the West and Catholic monks from the East, as well as Buddhist monks, kind of a conclave where they discussed issues they had in common. This was probably the most formative experience in Thomas Merton's life, and it was at the end of his life. Dylan ended up finding, I think, his redemption through continuing with the music and going through, as you mentioned last week, his many phases. He went through his country western phase and kind of his California phase with Blood on the Tracks and Desire, where he was living in Malibu. And then, of course, his evangelical phase, and then his many post-evangelical phases. So I think he found a redemption simply in continuing the work that he had started, finding new directions.
You know what made me a freak of nature? Do you know what album I really enjoyed?
Tell me.
Self-Portrait.
There you go. There you go. I frequently tell people, they ask me what my favorite Dylan album is. I say, you know, I'm an indiscriminate Dylan fan. I love the good stuff, and I love the bad stuff. And I maybe love especially the bad stuff. I love it all. I really don't pick and choose. But Self-Portrait is an amazing album. I think if you look at it from a creative artist's perspective, Self-Portrait was an amazing example of Dylan's process. And by that I mean when Dylan gets stuck creatively, he goes back to the music that he loved when he was younger. He has done this over and over again in his life. So you can hear the quality of the songwriting on Nashville Skyline waning a little bit. There are some great songs there, but it's a little thin as far as the richness of some of the albums that came before it, John Wesley Harding and Blonde on Blonde. And so I think he wanted to reproduce what he had done in 1967 with the famous Basement Tapes with the band, which was they just went through a lot of the old classics, rockabilly numbers and country classics and folk songs. And I think Dylan, with Self-Portrait, wanted to reproduce that. He's trying to find his inspiration again. I think it's a fascinating album because he is searching for the muse in that album. And then, of course, he goes on after that. Within a few years, he does Planet Waves, Blood on the Tracks, and Desire, which are three of his great, great albums.
Absolutely. Just remarkable stuff. And as we said last week, and you just alluded to it a couple of minutes ago, he reinvents himself over and over again, and he just seems to be the Dylan we need at the time.
You know, it's funny, talking about that creative process, he's going through that right now. I don't know if you've listened to any of his Sinatra albums. He's done five discs worth. That's two single albums and a triple album, five discs worth of covers of Sinatra songs over the last couple of years. I think it's another creative. He's going back to the music that he loved when he was younger, that he heard when he was a teenager on the pop stations. And I would not be surprised if he doesn't come out with something amazing and creative after this searching for the muse again.
You kind of surprised me. You know, we grow up with all of these myths, you know, that we just assume are true because we read it once in when we were 13. And it's hard to dislodge that kind of information. You say that Robert Zimmerman did not necessarily choose the name Dylan from Dylan Thomas. Is that, what do we know about that?
There's a lot of debate. I think ultimately he probably did think of Dylan Thomas. He claimed, of course, on various occasions that it was for an uncle called Dylan. Of course, the records show that he had no uncle named Dylan. And I think at one point he probably jokingly said that he named himself for Matt Dylan. Again, I think it's some of Gunsmoke fame.
Yes.
I think it's more of Dylan's intentional obfuscation that he just likes to confuse things. I think one interesting study, you know, he has in two instances that I can think of borrowed lines from the poems of Dylan Thomas. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was quite familiar with Dylan Thomas's poetry.
You, speaking of such, you say that it's fairly understood that Thomas Merton appears in two of Dylan's songs. Am I correct?
Oh, there really is no evidence that Bob Dylan was aware of Thomas Merton whatsoever. And what I was referring to there was in two of Dylan's songs, you think of Gates of Eden, where he refers to utopian hermit monks sitting side saddle on the golden calf, one of Dylan's great lines. I can't help but feel, this is just a gut feeling, nobody can prove it, but I can't help but feel that utopian hermit monk, Dylan had to have had Merton rattling around in the back of his brain somewhere. Two of Dylan's early women friends, Susie Rotolo in Greenwich Village, was an anti-war activist and was probably aware of Merton's anti-war writings, as were a lot of the Greenwich Village people. Merton, in fact, in 1962, published a famous poem called The Original Child Bomb, which I think is one of the most stunning anti-war, anti-nuke poems ever written, The Original Child Bomb. And I can't help but feel that Susie Rotolo would have been familiar with that. And of course, Joan Baez, who we know read the poetry of Thomas Merton and was familiar with it. And so you can't help but feel that she might have shared some of that with Bob Dylan as well. But there's no proof. I've scanned on the computer more than 1,300 pages of interviews, every public statement Bob Dylan ever made on a huge, massive website called Every Mind Polluting Word, if you're interested in looking for every interview Dylan ever gave. And he nowhere mentions the name Thomas Merton.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, the very first thing I ever read of Thomas Merton was a foreword or a preface to the Bhagavad Gita that Swami Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada, the head of the Hare Krishna movement, published in the late 60s. Are you familiar with that?
I am not familiar with that. What was that like? That must have been very interesting.
Oh, it really was. He refers to, there are three, again, I don't know if you call them prefaces or introductions or what, but there were three of them. I forget who the third one was, but the first one was Thomas Merton.
Huh.
And the second one was Allen Ginsberg. And I was just 15 years old, and sent me to the moon.
That is fascinating.
So.
Well, you have figures like the Dalai Lama, who was not particularly impressed with Christianity, but when he met Merton, he said that Merton, for the first time, the Dalai Lama understood what a Christian was after he met Merton, which I thought was an interesting statement. And of course, Thich Nhat Hanh, I'm a great admirer of his writing as well. Thich Nhat Hanh really detested Catholics and because of what they had done in French Vietnam during the 50s.
Yes.
And again, Merton convinced him that there were Catholics that were willing to work with him and by his side.
You mentioned in the book something I never knew, that Merton had a therapist. Do we know anything about that relationship, about why he was under therapy, did in his journal? Obviously, we will know nothing from the therapist, but from Merton himself, do we know anything about what he was dealing with and how the therapy went?
That's a very good question. From the journals, we know that the therapist was a general therapist for the community, for monks that needed it. And you get the impression that there were a lot of monks. That's a very hard life. It's a very difficult life, the monastic life, the discipline. So I think James Weigel, who was Merton's psychiatrist, was probably pretty popular in the monastery. The details of their relationship, I don't remember a lot of details, but I know Merton called on him particularly during this phase when he was having the affair with the student nurse. The psychiatrist, James Weigel, recommended that Merton break it off. Merton refused to break off the relationship for many months. And I think it really strained the relationship with James Weigel.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to WGVU. This is Common Threads, an interfaith dialogue. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Robert Hudson. He is the author of The Monk's Record Player, Thomas Merton, Bob Dylan, and the Perilous Summer of 1966. Thomas Merton came to fame with his book, Seven Story Mountain. And you indicated in the book, you came out and said that the early drafts were censored by the Catholic Church. And I'm curious, are those drafts available?
That would be interesting. I have not asked anybody at the Thomas Merton Archive at Bellarmine University in Louisville whether those drafts are available. I have the feeling they were destroyed. It's certain that the Catholic censors took out about a third of the original manuscript because Merton was too honest about his relationships, particularly with women, before he entered the monastery. Like Augustine, he fathered a child out of wedlock when he was still in college. And I think his honesty about that relationship probably rubbed the censors the wrong way. They also recommended that he delay publishing the book and that he find a a writing teacher to teach him how to teach him grammar. He did them one better by forming a relationship with Evelyn Waugh, the great English novelist, mm-hmm. who became his writing mentor and his editor for the English edition of Seven Story Mountain.
And am I correct that it's in this book that you say that we never know who that child was whom he fathered? So that person, the offspring of Thomas Burton, could very well be alive today.
It could be. The thought is that one of Merton's friends, I believe, I'm not sure where this information comes from, is fairly certain that the girlfriend and the child died during the Blitz, during the war.
Oh.
So they may be long deceased.
I see. And the Merton of Seven Story Mountain and the Merton of the 1960s seem to be tremendously different.
Yeah, people. They really are.
Did Merton write anything where he actually, I don't want to say apologized, unless in fact he did, but really tried to set the public straight in terms of, this is who I was, and I hope to God you're not taking all of this too terribly seriously, and really you should kind of take a look at me now. Is there anything like that?
He didn't publish anything that I can think of among his books during his lifetime, but that kind of sentiment runs throughout his journals. He really distanced himself from Seven Story Mountain really by the late 50s. His revelation on the streets of Louisville, where he realized that he felt in solidarity with the entire world, changed the direction of his writing. Before then, he pretty much felt that monastic solitude, contemplation, and prayer were the answers to all questions. After his revelation in Louisville, he became much more concerned about the state of the world and trying to figure out what he could do about it. Now, of course, he, in writing his socially activist material, his books at that time, he ran afoul of a lot of the Catholic clergy who declared that he was anti-Catholic, and they even banned his writing for a time. That's kind of a fascinating story, because he was told by the head of the Trappist order that he could no longer write on anti-war and anti-nuke topics because it was upsetting too many of the conservatives in the Catholic Church.
But it wasn't anti-Catholic.
No.
Not theologically.
Not really at all. In fact, it was extremely Catholic and very traditional theology. So Merton decided that he didn't have to stop publishing, that he had to stop publishing, but he did not want to stop writing. So he started kind of a Samizdat series of letters to friends and well-placed people, gatekeepers, about those issues. So he kept writing, mimeographing these letters and sending them off privately to people, including Ethel Kennedy. In his letter to Ethel Kennedy, I think he significantly says that he admires President Kennedy, her brother-in-law.
This is during Kennedy's life?
This is during Kennedy's life in 63, 62, I'm sorry. And he says that, Thomas Merton says in this letter to Ethel Kennedy, that ultimately the Russians are not our enemy. War itself is our enemy. It's fairly certain that she passed that letter on to President Kennedy. And this was just literally months, if not weeks, before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one can't help but wonder how much effect a major Catholic theologian like Merton would have had on John F. Kennedy and his decisions during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Also, during that same year, Pope John the 23rd issued finally the Terris in Pacem, the Peace on Earth encyclical, in which he officially declared that the Catholic Church could no longer support war of any kind in a nuclear age, and that the Catholic Church was officially becoming a peace church. Again, and this is documented, Pope John was quite influenced by Merton's writings on war and anti-nuclearization. So ultimately, even though he was not allowed to publish, his writings had a tremendous influence and really changed the Catholic Church and maybe even the direction of the world. So a monk living alone in the middle of Kentucky actually can affect the entire world, I think is an amazing fact. At the same time, of course, he was being investigated by the FBI, which I think is one of the most fascinating things about Merton, is that a monk living alone writing in the middle of Kentucky could be considered a threat to national security and investigated by the FBI.
Do we have those records out now?
We do, yes. Most of them were because he corresponded, they started in the 50s because he corresponded with Soviet writer Boris Pasternak of Dr. Zhivago fame. But of course, he was friends with the Berrigans, and Merton helped found the Catholic Peace Fellowship, which was one of the leading anti-war organizations in the 60s.
One of the shames, there are many, many shames we could think, oh, if only he'd lived to blank, if only he'd lived to see this. But if he would, of course, if he was alive today, would have been able to see that he was right, and that historians have put him on the right side of history.
Yeah, they really have. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. So you've been both a Merton fan and a Dylan fan for many, many years. Did one lead you to the other, or did it just so happen that at some point you realized, hey, wait a minute, I like Merton, I like Dylan. Hey, there's a confluence here. What happened?
I was, if you can picture me back in the late 60s, you were there, sitting in a basement with friends, you know, with the black lights and the flashing lights to the music and listening to Dylan bootleg albums at that point. I was vaguely aware of Merton as a poet who was loosely linked with a lot of the beat poets. He was in many of those same anthologies that I was reading because I loved the beat poets at that time. But I really didn't start, so I actually considered Merton as a poet before I considered him a spiritual figure. By graduate school, the late 70s, 10 years later, I became more aware of Thomas Merton. I was going through a spiritual revival in my life. I think Merton in some ways kind of rescued me from a more conservative brand of evangelicalism. I liked his openness to other world religions. I liked his spiritual approach. So I began reading a lot of Merton in graduate school. It wasn't until the 90s, really, when Merton's journals were finally released, 25 years after his death, according to his will, that I discovered constant references to Dylan in the journals. So I started looking at the letters, his literary essays, and his poetry, and found that Dylan, for that phase of 1966, was a major, major influence.
Being an evangelical and being a fan of both Merton and Dylan, so when you're in the group and you're in your mix of friends and family, do you find yourself in awkward spaces at mocktail parties? No, seriously, that's a terrible stereotype. I'm kidding, but really, if you were to paint someone as a Merton and a Dylan fan, and if you were just to sort of use your stereotypes to come up with a person, you probably wouldn't come up with someone who identifies as an evangelical Christian.
Right. Well, I don't think I identify. I haven't identified as an evangelical Christian for a long time, though I still consider myself a Christ follower. But I think what you're getting at is kind of epitomized by two encounters I had back in graduate school. One woman saw me reading Thomas Merton's No Man Is an Island, and she was an evangelical and said, "What in the world are you reading that for?" She was very threatened by the idea of a Catholic monk. The second woman, I was dating her, and she was very conservative, and she finally said, "You know, if we're going to get serious, if we're going to get married, you're going to have to choose between me and your Bob Dylan obsession." And I chose Dylan, and I never looked back.
You're not working on Maggie's farm. And it says here in your bio, hang on a second here, let me see this, that you're a member of the International Thomas Merton Society. What is that?
It is an organization of scholars that have annual conferences. It's based at Bellarmine University in Louisville. Mm-hmm. And it's simply a gathering of people that are interested in Thomas Merton. There is a West Michigan chapter, which meets at Baker Bookhouse on Wednesday nights, I think the second Wednesday of every month. And I'm a frequent attender of that. Bill and Beth Murphy are the founders of that group. It's an offshoot of the International Society, so it's...
Oh, that's nice to know. Again, it's at Baker Book House.
Yep. 7 p.m., the second Wednesday night of every month.
Do you happen to know Father Patrick Collins?
I think he attends there. Yes, he does.
Okay. Father Collins is... sat in your chair more than a few times.
Okay,
in our common threads. He's a good friend.
Brilliant man.
Yes, and brings a tremendous insight to contemporary Christianity, the Catholic Church in particular.
He really does.
Yeah, wonderful. And you mentioned that you've got another book in the works.
I do. I'm currently writing a book on writing poetry. So that's one of my other avocations is poetry writing, which I've done since high school as well. So it's called The Art of the Almost Said, A Guide to Writing Poetry, which won't be released until next year, but it's from Bold Vision Books in Texas.
Ah, wonderful, wonderful. Well, Robert, thank you so much for being with us this week and last week as well. It's been a lot of fun and very informative.
Thank you, Fred. All I can say is you are good at what you do, so thank you so much for having me here.
My pleasure. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. My guest this week, last week as well, Robert Hudson, the author of The Monk's Record Player, Thomas Merton, Bob Dylan, and The Perilous Summer of 1966. Please join us again next week right here on WGVU-FM for another episode of Common Threads.